There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Hello there, ladies and gentlemen. This is Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. I want to welcome you to another adventure with Progressive News Network. Today we're going to be interviewing Dr. Catherine Albrecht, a privacy expert, award-winning author, broadcaster. She's also a Christian prophecy speaker and a breast cancer survivor. She's authored legislation, testified before the FTC and lawmakers around the globe. She's written for Scientific American, granted over 2,000 media interviews to the New York Times, NPR, Today Show, Coast to Coast AM, CBS Evening News, to name just a few. Dr. Albrecht was also appointed by the New Hampshire Governor, John Lynch, to serve as an expert member of the state's two-year RFID commission. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Albrecht.
Program this morning, how are you?
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Albrecht. We want to welcome you to the show. You are such an interesting person, obviously a person who has thought long and deeply about many issues, but we're here first and foremost to talk about privacy and your interest in personal privacy and personal information security. Dr. Albrecht, why don't you talk to us a little bit about how you were alerted or the issue became foremost in your mind about how we can have some privacy in this interconnected world of that we live in today. Could you talk a little about how you got interested in the subject?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Richard, privacy, I've been working on this issue since 1999 as a privacy advocate. I actually got started fighting supermarket frequent shopper cards, which the majority of Americans have no idea how that is creating a vast food registration system, not only in the U.S. but across the entire globe. People get worried about, you know, their guns being registered and taken away from them. They need to probably think about their food being registered and taken away, because we're actually seeing that happen in Venezuela now, where the shopper cards are being used to literally prevent you from buying food. Even if you go to multiple stores, they limit you to X amount of bread per week, and you can't exceed that, and you have to ID yourself and register the food. And we're all doing that already with these frequent shopper cards. 2003, I became aware of a technology called RFID, or radio frequency identification, and the fact that some of the biggest corporations on the globe were making plans to secretly embed these devices that are essentially tracking devices into all of the consumer products sold across the globe. As they put it, everything from jumbo jets to sewing needles would contain its own unique ID number and be remotely trackable. So, ick. I found out about that. I launched a consumer privacy group actually in 1999 called Caspian, Consumers Against Supermarket Privacy Invasion and Numbering. And since that time, of course, my interests have expanded far beyond the supermarkets, but I still have definitely a heart for retail issues and the things people buy and sell. And the reason for that is because when I was a little girl, my grandmother sat me down and told me that there would be a time when you would not be able to buy and sell unless you had a number, and that number would be on your right hand or your forehead. And, of course, I'm referring there to the prophetic book of Revelation that talks about the mark of the beast that will come about in the dark times as we kind of get the world taken over. So a lot of that seems like it's unfolding as we speak. We've got now numbered payment systems that even when I was a little girl, I couldn't even figure how you could pay with a number. I'd never seen a credit card. There weren't cash registers with computers in them. There was no internet, no satellite uplinks. None of this stuff existed. So it's pretty extraordinary that in those 20, 30 years or so since I was a girl, actually 34 years now, I guess, since I was a girl, things have really progressed very quickly. In 2007, we put an end to the chipping of human beings with implantable microchips, which was a great coup. You can learn all about that if you go to antichips.com and chipmenot.com. We've got the story up there of how that occurred. Back in 2007, those same implantable microchips they wanted to put into products, they were putting them into humans. They were injecting them into Alzheimer's patients in Florida, patients as part of a Blue Cross Blue Shield trial. Diabetic patients were getting injected with these chips. It was awful. And we revealed the story. I actually kind of was a whistleblower. I guess I wasn't on the inside, but I can relate to Ed Snowden right now because I worked for 6 months quietly behind the scenes with the Associated Press reporter Todd Lewin to break that story that those microchips cause cancer. And when we broke that story, published academic, you know, research articles and medical journal articles showing that these implants cause cancer, we were able to stop. Pretty much stop all of that in its tracks. The people got their microchips removed. The company's stock value went from $11 a share to 25 cents a share, and they were delisted from the stock exchange. That's the Verichip Corporation, or they go by a bunch of different names. They used to be Digital Angel, and you know, who knows what they call themselves now. But we got them stopped, and then in 2009, I realized that while I was focusing on all of these physical tracking methodologies and techniques, that the online tracking had become completely out of control. In 2009, I became aware that Google was essentially not a search engine, but a market research company. And not only just a market research company, but a market research company that was working for the government. And a great example of how this came to my attention, I had used Google for our best-selling book on RFID called Spy Chips, published in 2006. My co-author, Liz McIntyre, and I had done all of our research on Google, as does everybody else in the country. We didn't even think twice about it. And then in 2009, I learned that Google makes a record of every single thing that we search for, and that because they make those records, they know everything. I mean, they know what people had for dinner last night because you wanted to look up the recipe for chicken cordon bleu. And where'd you go? You went on Google and typed in chicken cordon bleu. They know where your doctor is because when you needed to cancel the appointment, you didn't bother looking up the phone number. You just went on Google and typed in, you know, Dr. Joe Schmo, oncologist, and voila, now Google knows you have cancer. So, you know, those kinds of things are actually pretty frightening if you really think them through. And the place that I learned about this was when Google made a bet with the Centers for Disease Control that they could detect a flu outbreak before the CDC. And if you'll recall, back around that time, there was this big swine flu fear. Everybody was terrified that this thing was going to wipe us all out. And Google said, well, you know, I know the CDC has a flu map that they put up, but we have even more insight into Americans' health than the Centers for Disease Control. We know more than the federal government. So they had kind of a friendly wager to see who could find the outbreaks faster. And Google created an algorithm that just kind of sat like a spider waiting for people to log on and type in their searches. And if they saw that the combination of searches you typed made it look like you, you know, gave them the indication that you had the flu, then they'd, you know, put a red dot on a map. And here's how it would work. You'd be on Google, you'd look up, I don't know, chicken soup or Robitussin or your company's sick leave policy, and they'd go, boom, gotcha, we got a live one. And then they would identify you, of course, because they have your IP address when you're on their website. If you're logged into a Gmail account or a Google Calendar, Google Voice, whatever, they know exactly who you are. They would pinpoint your location, put a red dot on a map, and then after a couple of days of this, they took the map and they went to the CDC and said, here's our map, look, check it out. And the CDC said, well, I'll be dipped. You guys did detect the flu outbreak before we did. It took us a couple more days to even find it. Wow, Google, you really do have your finger on the pulse of America. So when I discovered that, I said, I've got to stop using Google because I, you know, they're not, it's not a one-way street where they're just giving me all the information I want. You know, I mean, think about it. They're not your mom. Why is Google giving you the answer to every question you ever asked? And the answer is because Google is not a search engine. Let me address this saying that they're not a search engine, they're a market research company. Back in the 1980s, I actually got my undergraduate degree in marketing, and this was before the Internet. One of my professors told me that one of the toughest things we'd ever have to do would be market research because people don't want to tell you honestly their true views about things, and they'll hide certain aspects of their lives from market researchers. So imagine if I were to call you up, Rick, and say, hey, I'm with Acme Market Research. Do you have like 20 minutes to answer a bunch of questions? You'd say no. And then even if you did say yes, once I got going on my questions, hey, ever been bankrupt? Got any financial problems? Fighting with your wife? Maybe going through a divorce? Any kind of, you know, bankruptcy? Ever had cancer? What are your health concerns? You know, you'd say, take a hike. Go away. Who are you? So what Google did, recognizing that people don't provide that information voluntarily, is they provided traps, as it were, honey traps, for us to deposit it for them to make their job easy. So if you think about what the Google search engine is, it is a gaping window on the screens of every person in America, every person on the globe practically, where it says, hey, we're market researchers, deposit your latest thoughts here so we can record them and know more about you. And so you go on there and you've got the you know, you're in your office or your home and you've got the door shut, you think you're alone, and you type your deepest, inmost questions into Google. You know, if a woman has a miscarriage, she's typing that in there. If you're going through, you know, drug addiction, you're typing that in there. If you're going through whatever. So Google exists not to be your best friend and give you every answer under the sun. Google exists truly to be a spy that sits in the middle of your home that collects every thought that you have in passing and gets you to thank them for the privilege. So then you move forward to 2006. And Google, in that year, came out with Gmail. And I was one of the coalition of privacy groups that signed a coalition letter against Google about Gmail. What Gmail did for the very first time was say, hey, it's free email, just like Hotmail and Yahoo, which had been around for a long time. But this is the free email, quote, unquote, free email, that's going to give you lots of gigabytes of storage. And there's just one little catch. You have to let us read all of your messages. And we wrote a letter and we said, if you do that, you're going to set a dangerous precedent for other companies to follow, and it's going to change the nature of people's understanding of what communications and mail even is, because it's supposed to be private. Well, sure enough, they did it anyway, and now here we are 7 years later, and you've got not only Google doing that, but now Hotmail, Yahoo, Microsoft, they've all changed their policies now to watch everything that you write. And if you think about it, you know, Google could only get so far knowing everything that crosses your mind in a search. What they then wanted to expand to was knowing everything else about your life. So by having a Gmail window there in which now you're really typing some juicy stuff. I mean, you're like writing to your babysitter, hey, I'm going to be out of town this weekend. I need you here to watch the kids. My kids are Johnny and Julie, and they're 6 and 5, and here's my home address, and here's the number of where we'll be vacationing if you need to reach us. You know, all this kind of really personal details that you would never type into a search engine, but you totally type into email. Not only that, you know, I talked to a friend recently. She said, oh, my gosh, Yahoo's doing this too. I was like, fully, Yahoo's doing it probably worse than anybody right now. And she said, well, I just sent my tax return back to my accountant through my Yahoo account as an attachment. Are you telling me Yahoo now knows everything about my income? I said, you better believe it. Their policy plainly states that they will make a copy of every attachment, that they will scan it and perform, quote, content analysis on everything you send or receive to or from a Yahoo account. Gmail does the same thing. Hotmail does the same thing. That's the business they're in. So we, just in response to all of this, when kind of after we stopped the human microchipping, I said, all right, well, now we've got to come up with a way to stop Google. And, of course, I can't stop Google. They're the biggest, you know, one of the biggest corporations on planet Earth. So what I did instead was help to develop an alternative to Google. So since 2009, I have helped to create a search engine called StartPage, which gives you access to Google results without being in the Google microscope. So what happens, you go to startpage.com, you type in your search, we submit it to Google, they never see you, they only see us. We get the Google results, we strip away all their tracking cookies and other garbage, and then we give you those results privately. And then we delete all records of your visit on our website. So no IP address recorded, no tracking cookies, we delete you entirely. So at the end of the day, we have no idea who's been on our website and no idea what they've searched for. So that's our business model. We have ads that are contextual. Unlike the ads run through Google and Yahoo and Bing, the spy search engines, where they base the ads on what they saw in your email last week to your brother-in-law, we base it only on the ad for the thing that you're searching for. So kind of like the old days, if you read Field & Stream magazine, the ads in the magazine would be for fishing poles. Well, nowadays, if you look up, you know, Field & Stream magazine, we will give you 1 to 3 ads, or even 0 in some cases, 0 to 3 ads, about fishing poles. So you can click on them, you can not click on them, totally up to you, totally private, startpage.com. And as far as the email situation goes, that has gotten much, much worse in recent weeks. In fact, just this month, the month of June, Yahoo has forced all of its users, some of whom have been with them for 10, 15 years, to, quote, upgrade to a new platform. And when you upgrade to the new Yahoo platform, you agree to allow them to read and scan and perform content analysis on all of your communications. So every email you send from a Yahoo account is automatically copied, read, analyzed, keywords are removed. It goes into their marketing database. But I think more important still, it goes into this NSA database, because as Edward Snowden so heroically has brought to our attention, and may the Lord bless this man, those databases that are being kept by Google and Yahoo and Outlook and AOL and Facebook and all those companies, those are going directly also to the NSA and to the big spy apparatus. So who, you know, if you wanted to know who all of the people are in this country who, for example, supported Ron Paul, and I'm a huge Ron Paul supporter, where would you go? Well, you would go to Google, and you'd see who was typing in that kind of stuff and emailing their friends, of, hey, I'll be at the Ron Paul rally tonight. Are you coming too? You would go to these internet companies to identify your political enemies. So it's no surprise that we had the big Tea Party IRS scandal right on the heels of all of this, or right before all of this, because that's exactly what this kind of information makes possible. You identify your political enemies, you identify the people who oppose your corrupt power, and then you go after them. And whether you go after them with an IRS audit, which is a pretty nasty thing if you've ever been through one, or whether you go after them by locking them up and throwing them in the gulag or in a concentration camp, you know, it's a matter of degree. It's not a matter of, you know, it's an issue of degree, not kind. And I think if we're not careful, we're going to be heading in that direction, because that's where this kind of snooping and totalitarian top-down control always winds up. So there it is in a nutshell.
Wow, Doctor, there are so many areas I'd like to pursue. Let me go back to the beginning. And if this is not an area that you remain focused on, just wave me off, and I'm fine with that. But, you know, you raise a point right at the beginning when you talked about your opposition to the coupon cards or the savings cards at the grocery stores and the pharmacies. We all see these things. Many of us use these things because they do provide a modest economic incentive for you to participate in this problem, in this program. One of the questions I had, and I've never seen it addressed, and maybe you know about this, is obviously beyond the, you know, the Winn-Dixie or the Publix or the Piggly Wiggly or whatever the particular vendor is, that data is being aggregated by whom? Do we know that? We know who else is getting that besides obviously the government? But
the government actually may or may not be getting that information. That's an interesting question. We know people do not understand what happens when they scan the frequent shopper card. And we did a bunch of research back in 2000 and 2001 looking into, do they really save you money? And, in fact, I did a research with the Wall Street Journal. I did another one with the CBS in Boston. And we did a number of price comparisons around the country on the stores that do and don't have the cards. And what we found was, first of all, stores with cards on average have much higher prices than stores without cards. So there's the first thing, that even when you take advantage of the card sales, you're still paying more money than you would pay just by going down the street and buying things on sale at the card-free store. But the other thing that we discovered in doing all of our research into these shopper cards is that the reason there's two reasons they offer the cards. Number one, they want a record of everything you buy. And they want to be able to identify who buys what so that they can do some things I can tell you about in a minute. But the second reason that they do this is because what it does is it takes the sale prices and makes them not available to the 10 to 20% of people who don't scan the card. So there's a huge financial incentive. It's basically a form of screwage against the people who don't have a card. What people don't realize, your supermarket is not who drives the sales. If you see, you know, Häagen-Dazs ice cream, or that's not a good example, Breyers ice cream is a good example, because I actually saw this. If you see Breyers ice cream and it's on sale for $3 for a quart instead of its usual $6 for a quart, then you say, oh, wow, my supermarket is giving me a great deal. But that's not the case. Breyers ice cream would be on sale because the Breyers Corporation itself, or the wholesaler, the distributor who gets it to the store, wants to put it on sale. And they might do that for a bunch of reasons. They might do it because it's the month of January and they're not selling a lot of ice cream, but they know little Timmy has a birthday party and they want you to buy their brand. So when the summer rolls around and you're buying ice cream, Breyers will be your brand of choice. They might do it because they've got an overstock. There's just too darn much ice cream in the warehouse and they want to move it out. So at that point, they'll put it on sale. Or it might just be part of a promotional thing so that they can increase their market share for this quarter, for example. So for all those reasons, what happens is Breyers says to all of the supermarkets that carry its brand, hey, listen, for the month of June, we're going to put all of our ice cream at a discounted price of, instead of $6, it's going to be $3. And so we're going to make it available to you for, I don't know, $2.50, however they do that with their markup, and you put it on the shelf at $3. Thank you. All right, well, the stores that don't have cards just put the ice cream on the shelf at $3, and then they run an ad and you get the flyer with your newspaper that says, ice cream on sale, $3, come shop at, you know, Groceries R Us, whatever. The stores that have a card, though, they only make that discounted price available to the 85% or so of people who scan the card. So when you go into Safeway or Kroger or any of these other stores that have the card, then you'll see, oh, it's $3 with card. But if you don't scan your card, they charge you the full whopping $6. And so they are making $3.50 off of those people who don't scan the card, whereas they would only normally make 50 cents off of the people if they didn't have the card. So you can already see right there, there's a huge economic incentive for them to basically perform screwage on the people who do not have a card. And, you know, I would think, you would think that the people who don't have cards are, you know, maybe they're so wealthy they send their maids to the grocery store to do their shopping. But, and I used to think that too, until one day I was standing at, I was doing a protest in Seattle, and I was standing in line, actually just kind of trying to observe how the store was working, and this guy in front of me, this old guy who can barely walk, you know, probably in his 80s, he comes up to the counter and he puts, like, I don't know, it was like three pieces of fruit on the counter. And this 18-year-old, you know, she scans it and she's all bright and cheery. Do you have your, what was it, I'm trying to remember the name of it. It was a Kroger brand. So do you have your Kroger card? And this guy just looks at her and doesn't even understand what she's saying. He's like adjusting his hearing aid. He's like, what? My what? You know, your Kroger's card, your frequent shopper card. Anyway, long story short, she rings it up. It comes to like $6.
$6
for like three little pieces of fruit. And this guy is pulling out his wallet to pay it. And finally, the lady behind him, I watched this whole thing happen. The lady behind him says, oh, my gosh, give him my card. She hands her card. They scan it through, and it goes down to like $1.50. So that's the kind of people that they're taking advantage of, the people who don't speak English, the people who are too old or frail or feeble to understand, disabled people, people who are traveling from out of town, people who are in a hurry, moms who are in a rush and don't have the time to, you know, dig the cart out. That's who they're taking advantage of. So right there, there's an economic problem with these cards, I believe, that we should not have two-tiered pricing systems in this country. If there's a sale, it should be democratically available to all people. And I, you know, as a free market libertarian, I don't believe the government should impose that, but I believe that we shoppers should demand that. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is, what do they do with the data? So they have the cards because, number one, they can basically rip people off who don't have it. And then number two, they have them because they want to collect your shopping data. So by having these cards, it enables them to know every single stick of broccoli and pint of Häagen-Dazs and thing of ground beef that your family has consumed. And what they're doing now, and this is, you know, if you think about it, it's not surprising, although it'll kind of shock you, they have converted every object in the supermarket into a detailed nutritional breakdown. And so they know down to the last gram of fat and sodium exactly how your family is eating. So who has an interest in that? Insurance companies and federal health agencies. And both of them having expressed an interest in getting that data, and in fact, up here where I live in New England, the biggest grocery chain up here is called Stop and Shop, and they've actually told, I mean, I have it on tape, that they said that they were sharing the shopper card data with HMOs. So your HMO can take a look there and decide whether to cancel your policy, raise your rates, deny you coverage, you know, do whatever they want to do based on not liking how you eat. And you can say, well, you know, I guess that's Stop and Shop and that's my HMO. But, you know, when the federal government gets in charge, then you've really got an issue. Because under right now, under the British national healthcare system, the Brits are accessing shopper card data in a trial with Tesco, their big, the biggest supermarket over there in the UK. And they are looking through, combing through people's shopper card records to find people whose purchases make them look like fat slobs, and now they're trying to manipulate those people into making different purchasing decisions and eating differently. So already the national health people are combing through this data, and I believe it's just a matter of time here in the U.S. once we have Obamacare in full swing and we're paying for one another's health care, for people to begin saying, you know, you're not allowed to just eat nothing but potato chips and soda all day long because you're going to make yourself sick doing that. I'm going to have to pay for it. So I think it's a matter of time before the government starts using and the private corporations and the insurance companies start using those shopper cards in order to ration certain foods, in order to restrict certain people against purchasing certain kinds of foods, in order to raise the rates on people who don't eat in ways that are approved. And I think ultimately what's going to happen is what's happening right now in Venezuela, where 65 supermarkets are all in league with frequent shopper cards to restrict the amount of food that Venezuelans can buy. So in Venezuela, they've got this horrible problem where price controls have led to food shortages. Well, price controls always lead to shortages. You know, repeat after me. They always lead price controls lead to shortages. So in Venezuela, which Hugo Chavez was in charge trying to create his socialist utopia there, and the only result is now they ran it completely out of toilet paper. The whole nation had no toilet paper a couple weeks ago, and they're out of food. So what they're doing is they're using the frequent shopper card infrastructure put in place in all their grocery stores, just like here in the U.S., to say, now in order to buy food, you have to scan your government ID. And, you know, we've got the scanner right here. It's been in use for the last 10 years for the stupid frequent shopper card. So now we just re-rigged it. So now you scan your driver's license. And when you scan it, we make a record. Oh, you bought a gallon of milk. And you have a family of how many? Oh, yeah, that's right. You have 3 kids. So you're allowed 2 gallons of milk every 2 weeks. And so you buy it at grocery store A, and then you go across town 5 days later to grocery store B, and you try to buy a gallon of milk. And when you get to the cash register and you scan your driver's license, it goes, bah, nope, sorry, got to put it back on the shelf. You've exceeded your quota. So it's rationing is what it is.
Yeah.
We're going to see the same thing here, whether it's because of a shortage, whether it's because of health reasons, whatever, you're going to see the same thing here. And we stupidly have allowed this infrastructure to be built by not opposing these cards when we should have.
I was involved in the I've been in the Internet business for a long time. And in the late 90s, I was at a conference, and they were touting some of the new products that were being rolled out. And there was a product rolled out that it actually stopped me in my tracks. I've been a technologist and an early adopter for a long time. The thing that struck me and the thing that I thought that no one was quite getting the impact of was, here was the argument. In those days, through the 70s and the 80s and even most of the 90s, databases, because they were all so idiosyncratically designed, each one was kind of different, whether it be in a different software platform or a different format. The tables, the data didn't quite align, and there was, you know, there was a great degree of incompatibility. The driver's license information didn't track with the auto tag agency, which didn't track with your voting information. And consequently, all of these databases existed in their own informational space. But what I saw happening was several companies came out with software that said, wait a minute, that's not a problem. We can rig it so that your criminal control information database, your driver's license control information database, your auto tag information, this, that, the other thing, there are new database tools coming out back then that allowed all these databases to talk together. And I thought, oh my God, what this is going to do is create what we're seeing right now, is an informational space where every controlling entity can cross-reference any data whatsoever, whether it be what food you're buying, where you're getting gas, what toll booth you went through, where your kids go to school, what, how many times you voted, what you bought at the drugstore. And the potential for misuse is just tremendous. Another thing I wanted to ask you before we got too far away from your earlier comments was the RFID embedding, which is now being done on animals basically without thought. No one seems to get the ultimate impact of that. And another avenue that I've heard of recently is what they're calling GPS dust. Have you heard of that?
I've heard it called by different names. You can call it smart dust or RFID dust, and RFID antennas. There's a lot of ways to track things. Unfortunately, I'm looking at the clock, and I've actually got another appointment I need to run to, but I did want to...
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, no, and I just wanted, I know it can be discouraging to hear all of this, so I wanted to give people hope with some of the alternative products that we've helped to put out there. StartPage.com. As an alternative to Google, you can add it to your homepage. Right there at startpage.com, there's a little link there where you can add it to your browser. So instead of having the Google window in the upper corner, you've got the Start Page window. And one of the things that I'm trying to get all of the radio hosts, and Rick, I would appreciate if you'd think about this too, for us to all stop saying Google it. You know, Google the Panama Canal.
Oh, I never
Google
do
my
that.
Next guest. Yeah, it took me, even after I had created Start Page, it took me a couple of months to stop saying Google, if you can believe it. It's such a part of the language, and I think we all have to just stop saying Google this, Google that. It is not a verb. It's a multinational corporation in league with the NSA that is spying on Americans, and we need to stop giving them free advertising by mentioning their name all day long. And around these parts, we say Start Page it, just to encourage people, and they go, what's that? What do you mean Start Page it? And it opens up the conversation, and you can inform them about what Google is doing. The other thing I wanted to mention, Rick, here before I go, is that on the email portion, the Gmail, Yahoo, and Hotmail part of this, I've been working for the last 2 years to create a private alternative to those with the good folks at StartPage. So we have a new mail program coming out this fall. It's called StartMail, StartMail, just like it sounds, StartMail.com. And what we're doing is we've put together basically the email that we never read. We make an ironclad promise that we never read it. And you don't have to take our word for it, because we've built the infrastructure so that we can't read it. Your email sits on a user vault that cannot be accessed by anyone unless they have your PGP password to decrypt the vault. And that sounds complicated, but we've made it so easy that a 10-year-old could use it, but it is so powerful that even the most brilliant of hackers would not be able to get into it. So that's at startmail.com. It will not be free, because the Gmail accounts and Yahoo accounts, those aren't free either. They're basically giving you the equivalent of a Starbucks cup of coffee every month to let you read all of your email, which is about $5. So our service is going to be worth about, it's going to cost but somewhere between $5 and $10 a month. It's coming out later this fall. And if listeners to this radio program would like to get in on the ground floor of StartMail, they can go to startmail.com. They can sign up to be on our mailing list to get the first announcement when it comes out. And if they check the little box that says beta, then they can actually get a free trial account to kick the tires if they're willing to give us some feedback on the program and be beta testers. They can go
I've
to StartMail.com and sign up. Awesome. Thank you. So, and in fact, Rick, if you'd like, if you want to drop me a line, or we could talk off air here, if you let me know what name you would like, I can go ahead and reserve your name for you, and we'll go ahead and give you a free full-year account. So I would love to make that available to you, because I think we in the liberty movement, privacy people, media people, we've got to really think about how to get out of these other systems and really get privacy for our communications, because, you know, we're the only thing standing between, you know, the people and tyranny. It's the media and the activists and the people on the front lines. And I know you're one of them, and we want you to have free, protected, complete, private email so that you can do what you do best.
I've been recommending to my students and clients ixquick.com for years. And
there you go. I didn't even mention that, did I? ixquick, ixquick.com. Can I tell you the difference between ixquick
Please
and
do.
Start Page?
Please do.
Yeah, so ixquick has been around since 1999. It is we call them both the world's most private search engines. ixquick gives you results from search engines that do not include Google. And StartPage gives you only Google results. So you can really choose whether you want actual, you know, some people just want Google results. They like the quality of the results, but they don't like the tracking. So startpage.com is where you would get those. When you get there, you'll see powered by Google, but don't let it freak you out. We have no relationship with Google other than the ability to put their logo on there to tell you that we're really giving you real Google results, but they never see you. We never share any data with them. We're not owned by them. They don't invest in us. We don't invest in them. They're a separate company, and in fact, we're kind of at odds with one another on occasion. So startpage.com, 100% Google results, 100% privacy. ixquick or ixquick.com, 100% privacy, no Google. And then startmail.com, the new private email coming out.
Can I ask you one quick last easy question?
Absolutely.
I would imagine there'd be quite a bit of federal pressure that your information
You're
should be available.
You're going to love the answer. You're going to love the answer. We are not based in the U.S. We're based in the Netherlands. I'm a true blue American gal. I buy American every time I can. But this is one time, and I got to say, especially in light of this NSA spying revelations and what Ed Snowden has told us, this is one time I'm really, really glad to be doing business with a country, with a company that's not under U.S. jurisdiction. StartPage and StartMail and ixquick, the parent company, is based in the Netherlands. It's family-owned by good Christian people. They're wonderful people. I know them personally. They are not subject to the Patriot Act. They are not subject to any U.S. courts or warrants or U.S. orders. They're not subject to any NSA or FBI demands. They're not subject to a PRISM program because they're not under U.S. jurisdiction. So it would take a lot. And, you know, I love the fact that they're Dutch, because the Dutch people, you know about Amsterdam and the red light district. They've got free pot smoking and prostitution is legal. I mean, it's kind of crazy over there. But what it means is that they take privacy really seriously.
Yeah.
They're probably, arguably, the most private country on planet Earth. And their courts, that filters all the way through their courts, their justice system, their government. They really hold people's privacy up as one of their highest values to defend. And so, you know, you would have to get, if the Patriot Act or somebody in the U.S. wanted to get access to any records, they would have to go through a Dutch court. And even then, if the Dutch court compelled us to turn something over, we'd say, fine, we don't even have any records. We keep
Yeah, that's
records
the beauty of your
people
system.
Who search. It's wonderful. So, yeah, you want records? Here you go. There's nothing in them. And then on Start Mail, we would say, you know, you want access? We can't give it to you because we can't get in. If you want to get a hold of Rick's email, you got to go to Rick and get him to give you the password and let you in. He's got the key. Don't look at us. And, you know, I had somebody ask me this morning, doesn't that mean that you're just going to be supporting criminals? No, it means that the law-abiding people of this planet will have a place to go and write their email without being snooped on by the government, which is what the Fourth Amendment was all about to begin with. And
when
people
existed.
Say, couldn't criminals abuse you? We say, I am not a law enforcement agent. I'm not a private investigator. It is not my job to solve crime. It is my job to provide email and search products for people. It is the government's job to solve crime. And if they want to solve crime, they've got plenty of methods to do it. If they believe that you're committing a crime, they can go to you and they can get you to tell their information. But we're not in the business of sitting around all day long collecting data on people in the off chance that they might commit a crime. And that kind of mentality is exactly how you wind up with this hideous NSA thing where everybody's being spied on all the time. And that's what we got to put an end to. So we're not participating in it. We want nothing to do with it. It's the wrong kind of mindset to have a free planet.
Well, thank you so very much, Dr. Albrecht. We really appreciate you coming on. And I hope you come out again, especially when you can talk up the release of the public version of Start Mail. Looking forward to it very much.
Oh, it's
going to
be so great. Thank you, Richard. God bless you. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
And you too.
I can't wait to come back and actually say, it's live, and here's your account. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
That was Dr. Catherine Albrecht of StartPage. and soon Start Mail, talking about internet privacy issues and a very, very interesting conversation. And I'm sure many of you out there are going to look at that grocery card and that pharmacy card a little different now, knowing how much information not only is being controlled right now from it, but the potential misuses, as you heard, in Venezuela, and unfortunately probably coming to a store near you. Well, thanks so much. Glad you could tune in for the Dr. Albrecht. Let me play a little bit of music. We'll do a little bit of news, and then we'll call it a day. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a real pleasure having you here. And this is a little tune to remind you that economic justice doesn't mean we hate the rich. It means we want a fair playing field, that all of us, all citizens, are under one rule of law.
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your pleasure yacht. All I want, just food for my baby, is to me my old job back. We work to build this country, mister, while you enjoyed a life of ease. You've stolen all that we built, mister. Now our children starve and freeze. So I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring.
Call me green or blue or red, this one thing I sure know, mister, my hungry babies must be fed. Take the two old parties, mister, no difference in them I can. But with a farmer labor party, we could set the people free. So
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back my job.
Oh, that was I Don't Want Your Millions, Mister. Oh, glorious, glorious congratulations to you Americans out there. My goodness gracious me, we're going to be at war in Syria before the day is out. What a great day it is. Drone Ranger, the Obama Dirty Wars. This is a story from Greg Palast, Thursday the 13th. About time Barack Obama ordered the drone strike that killed Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki, the 16-year-old American kid Facebooked his second-rate choice of hip-hop favorites. I say second-rate because Abdul was my son's age almost exactly, so I know the kind of crap they listen to. Now, this is Greg Palast again. Every Tuesday, President Obama personally checks off the names of people he wants to kill. Now, George Bush, a little more squeamish than Obama, never did that, but Mr. Obama felt those decisions were the president's responsibility. He wants to keep his own finger on the trigger, according to one report. A tidy, scheduled man, the president only picks his victims once a week, now called Terror Tuesday. On October 14, 2011, in the Shawa province of Yemen, Abdul went out with his cousins and friends for a good old U.S.-style barbecue when Obama's drone fired a rocket, blowing the teenagers to pieces, or I should say, peace. All that was left of Abdul was a piece of skull with long curly hair that allowed his relatives to identify this hunk of his head by his USA-type haircut. Obama didn't order the killings. Abdul's friends and cousins died, too. As a random act of crazy? Nope. Drama, no drama. Obama doesn't believe in random. Abdul's problem was that his father was Anwar al-Awlaki. Obama killed Abdul's dad as well. Daddy al-Awlaki, an American imam who voted for George Bush, had gone over to the side of the bad guys, and after leaving the U.S. broadcast pro-terrorism reports out of Arabia. We can argue until the cows come home about whether Daddy al-Awlaki wasn't a legitimate kill target. That is, after all, there is in the U.S. Constitution that the penalty for treason is death. I suppose that before executing him, a jury trial would have been nice, but nice isn't going to happen. So, okay, Barack, we'll let that one go. What about the 16-year-old? Obama didn't even pretend the kid was a terrorist, or terrorist in the making, or adopting in his way the father's crazy kill Americans crusade. What could justify the killing of Abdul? When asked, then White House press spokesman Robert Gibbs said, I would suggest that you should have a far more responsible father. Yeah, I guess he should have. Obama's minions tried to cover up the hit on the teenagers. Attorney General Eric Holder informed Congress of the killings by writing that U.S. drones had blown up Anwar al-Awlaki, the crazy cleric, and three other Americans who were not specifically targeted. Holder's comments make it seem like al-Awlaki's son was blown up with him, a sad case of collateral damage. But are you ready for this? The teenager, along with his cousins and friends, was killed 2 weeks after and hundreds of miles away from the site where the rockets killed his father. Obama's SEAL team sick. I was straightened out on the facts by Richard Rowley, America's most courageous investigative reporter. Rowley filmed, directed, and edited a brilliant, horrific, and brilliantly horrific documentary, Dirty Wars, previewing this week in the U.S. The film centered us on Rowley's reporting partner, the indefatigable Jeremy Scahill, who Rowley follows from the scene of a massacre at the wedding party in Afghanistan to an interview with a warlord in Mogadishu while under sniper fire. You might know Rowley as Ricardo, the pathologically calm cameraman portrayed in my book Vulture's Picnic. In Iraq, Rowley covered U.S. Army's assault on Fallujah, embedded with the insurgents. That was insane. Insane but brilliant. Our producer at BBC warned Ricardo he was one lucky cat, but he'd already used up 7 of his 9 lives. In Dirty Wars, Rowley and Scahill reveal that the drones are just one toy in our president's murderous toy chest. And the kill list is far larger than even a smart dude like Obama can tick off on a Tuesday. Scahill calculates the killing targets in Afghanistan and Pakistan now total more than 17,000. Drones can't kill them all. In 2009, a cruise missile hit Majala, a remote village of Bedouins in Yemen, killing dozens of herdsmen and 3 babies. Yemen's president, al-Abdul Saleh, took responsibility proudly for killing supposed terrorists. However, a courageous Yemeni reporter, Abdullah Haider Shai, visited the site, photographed the remains of the U.S. missile, and was promptly jailed. The U.S. is particularly shy about taking credit for a cruise missile kill, as it boosts al-Qaeda's recruitment drive in Yemen. Rowley and Scahill are the only U.S. reporters to have gone to the Bedouin village out and filmed the missile casing, cold evidence confirming the U.S. had entered a war without any legal declaration, and indeed in complete secrecy. Sound familiar? Scahill also revealed that while Yemen's President Saleh was nervous about keeping the reporter in prison, Saleh withdrew his pardon at the personal request of Barack Obama. Obama wanted the journalist not just silenced, but punished. WikiLeaks, cleaning up the dirty wars. I was curious. Did Scahill and Rowley make use of WikiLeaks? WikiLeaks was absolutely indispensable, Rowley told me, a treasure trove of State Department confessions confirming what they found on the ground. It was through WikiLeaks that they had discovered that President Saleh joked with U.S. operatives about lying to his Congress about the missile attack in Al-Maja. And it was WikiLeaks that Scahill found the warlord, Inda Ade, a.k.a. White Eyes, was on the USA payroll. I should say General White Eyes, a rank he gave himself in the Somali Army by pinning 3 stars on his jacket. Where did the U.S. military find this cutthroat? Previously, the WikiLeaks cables revealed the USA knew he was the protector of the al-Qaeda bombers that blew up the U.S. embassy in Nairobi. Rowley captures the warlord general on camera saying, The USA is the master in war. Quite a compliment from a natural-born killer like White Eyes. And General Eyes is quite right. The Drone Ranger's secret war is now spread to 75 countries, and all under the command of General William H. McRaven. USA Press is in love with McRaven, lauded as the man who planned the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound. But there's not one single USA network or paper that would report on Scahill's discovery that McRaven was also the guy who planned the night raid on the Afghan wedding party that killed the bride, the groom, and the groom's mother. Maybe that was a horrible mistake, but McRaven's crew, called the American Taliban by Afghans, made sure that no one would finger the U.S. Rowley and Scahill obtained the secretly recorded video of McRaven's commandos slicing the bullets out of the bride and groom's body to prevent their killer's identification. McRaven's semi-private army, the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, is warring in our name worldwide. In nations we won't name, and Obama will arrest you for naming them. Not even Orwell could have dreamed up that one. I asked about the value of WikiLeaks to Rowley and Scahill because of the ongoing trial of Private Manning and the impending capture of Edward Snowden, the contractor willing to blow away his career and freedom just to let you know that nice Mr. Obama has been spying on you. A rabbi from Nazareth once said, "The truth shall make you free." And that's exactly what Obama is afraid of. Faced with the truths revealed in dirty words, they know most Americans would cut themselves free of McRaven's SEAL Team 6. I'm convinced that the hit on al-Awlaki's son was meant to teach a lesson. If you want to be a martyr, we'll make your son and your mom and your daughters martyrs too. Such terror for terror can be, I'll admit, quite effective. During the Ronald Reagan wars, the gutless faux cowboy president sent weapons to Ayatollah Khomeini in return for his release of hostages taken by Hezbollah. The Russians got their hostages home and another way. The USSR didn't accept an arms-for-hostage deal. Rather, the KGB systematically assassinated the hostage-takers' cousins, mothers, and brothers, one by one, until Hezbollah released all the Russian hostages. By rocketing the children of those we fear, we are indeed teaching them a lesson. But what exactly are they learning? Next year, Malia Obama turns 16. Hope she never hears that harms come to Maya, while some chuckling spokesman for Al-Qaeda says she should have had a more responsible father. Stern, tough stuff, ladies and gentlemen. Stern, tough stuff. But I'm afraid that the wars that we're doing all over the world are pretty stern, tough stuff, too. Sending American troops to Iraq was stern, tough stuff. The bombing, the shock and awe was stern, tough stuff. Let's hope that one day soon our nation, our great nation, this great experiment in human liberty, this great experiment in self-government, will return to the values enshrined in the Constitution, return to the values represented by the Bill of Rights. All men are created equal. And as Abraham Lincoln said so powerfully, with malice toward none and charity for all. I say this as our government's giving itself the authority without a vote in Congress, with only the voices of the war hawks in their ears. Yes, it's time to aid the Syrian war. Having learned no lesson, they're building more war. Sober stuff. And I take no pleasure at all in talking about it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to let John Lennon say it. He said it so well. Gentlemen, let's give peace a chance. This is your host, News Director Richard Spezak, saying to you, there's a better world coming if we work on building it every day. Thank you so much. and we'll talk to you again.
Now come on, General, let's move fast. Your big chance is here at last. Now you can go out and get those reds, because the only good commie is one that's dead. And you know that peace can only be won when there's long while the kingdom comes. Sing it! 1, 2, 3.
What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn.
Louder!
Vietnam. And in 5, 6, let's open up early gates. Well, I ain't no time to wonder why. What the hell on the side?
Thanks so much. We'll see you Sunday. This is Richard Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network, saying, go in peace and be excellent to each other.